Accession number 16504, Reel 2.
Mr. Lane, Reel 2.
We didn't think at first to emigrate. We thought we could live poorly, but we could continue living in Vienna under the Nazis, because after all the Jews in Germany had lived since 1933. But of course the Kristallnacht in November 1938 taught us better, when all the shops and people were, quite a lot of my relatives were arrested. My father escaped arrest because we knew a Nazi who stood in front of the house and told them there are no Jews living in this house. He protected my father because he realized my father had been in the last war fighting for Austria.
How did he realize that?
So he protected us, yeah.
How did he realize that?
Well, you know, by talking. We knew them neighbors. By that time, we had already been thrown out of our council house and had been in ever smaller rooms, and in the end we were just living in two rooms. My sisters had received permission to work as maid servants in England, but there didn't seem to be any chance for me.
Was there a Kristallnacht in Vienna?
Oh yes, oh yes.
Did you see that?
Oh yes.
What happened?
Well, all the synagogues were smashed up and burned, and people were arrested. About 1,200 arrests were made, and people were sent. My brother-in-law was sent on that day to Dachau, although he was an American citizen. From then on, I tried hard to leave the country, but there didn't seem to be a chance.
They sent an American citizen to Dachau?
Yes. Yes, he was born in America, but came to Austria at the age of 6. His parents were Austrians living in America, and when the First World War broke out, they thought it was their duty to come back. They were afraid of a backlash in America. They came back to Vienna. But having been born in America, he could claim his American citizenship any time, which he did, but it didn't help him. And although we went to the American embassy, nothing happened until I asked a friend who was emigrating to America to alert the White House or whoever in American authorities that there's an American citizen. And this worked. The ambassador was recalled for, or at least he was reprimanded, and my brother-in-law was released, but had to leave Austria within 24 hours.
How long had he spent in Dachau?
About 6 months.
So, coming back to your own fate, can you take it a bit further, please?
Yeah, I had met in the underground, or overground, as it was at the time, I had met a Jewish friend who had greasy hands, and I said to him, "How come you work?" He said, "Oh, well, we are helping poor Jews who have been thrown out of their homes to take their furniture to their new place, sort of assist them. You can come and help us." So I did that as well. And I joined a group of about 30 or 40 youngsters who were with hand carts helping poor people to move their remains that have been left to them. And from there I was asked to work in the headquarters. It happened to be a Zionist organization. And as I had organizational skills, I was in the end looking after training camps, which they had about 2,000 youngsters in training camps, agricultural training camps, in preparation of working in Israel. And I must go back now a little. At school, I was one day asked whether I would like to correspond with an American lady. And I said yes, and I corresponded from then onwards, so that is from about 1930, with a teacher in Port Huron, Michigan. And she was a geography teacher and wanted to know, get mementos, postcards and things like that. And when it came to Hitler coming into Austria, she wrote me immediately, can I help you? And I said, yes, you could find somebody who can guarantee for me. And she invited the parents of the Jewish children in her class and told them my story. And one said, yes, I help him. And he wrote to his lawyer in Washington, could you explain how what I have to do? And he sent him a form, and the lawyer never heard, never got a reply. So he wrote after a while and heard the man had died. So that lawyer in turn wrote to his Jewish clients, I know of a fellow, and a man in Knox, Indiana, completely unknown to me, of course. One day I get a letter from the embassy, do I know a Mr. So-and-so from Knox, Indiana? I had to say truthfully, I don't. Oh, well, then you don't get a visa, because only relatives are allowed to guarantee. So meanwhile, I got the address of that man, I wrote to him, and he said, what have I got to do? And then he was told, well, as he is not a relative, you have to buy him an apartment in his name so that we know that he will be looked after, which he did, a complete stranger. And I was waiting for that visa when it became, oh yes, and then I was waiting for the visa, and meanwhile my sister in London had my photograph in her bedroom, and her boss came in to call her or something, and said, who is that, your boyfriend? She said, no, it's my brother. And he said, where is he? He said, well, he's in Vienna. He said, why is he leaving? War is going to break out. What is he doing in Vienna? He said, well, he can't get the visa. Now, that was a non-Jewish person, I must add. And he said, come on, pick up, we go to the Home Office, I know somebody there, you get a visa in 48 hours. Which he did. Within 48 hours, I had a visa, 3 weeks before outbreak of war. Now, the coincidences of this to happen are so fantastic, really. They're greater mathematically expressed than winning in the lottery, I think. And this is why I'm still alive. My parents have disappeared in Auschwitz.
When did you get the British visa?
Just 3 weeks before outbreak of war.
So August 1939.
And I went the next day. Pardon?
August 1939.
That's right, yes.
And so the visa arrived at your home. What
That's
did
right,
you,
yes.
Can you tell me about how you got to England?
Yes, just went on a train, and I practiced my English on the ship on an Indian student coming back to England. And he complained about the British, and so that was my first English lesson I had. And when I came, I couldn't understand any English, although I had 4 years of English. I went to the cinema. You know, at that time you could go at 2 o'clock and stay till midnight for sixpence. And all I understood, I remember, was when she said no to him. That's all I understood.
And the journey here was without problem?
Was no problem. Oh, no. I was arrested on the border in Cologne, or in Aachen, in La Chapelle. In the office where I helped them with the organizing of these camps, they had asked me to take some letters to Teddy Kollek, you know, the burgomaster or whatever you call him, the Lord Mayor of Jerusalem, who was in London at the time. And I had them in my luggage, and at the border, my luggage was searched, and they found these letters, and they asked me to come out, and they arrested me, and they phoned Cologne to collect, the Gestapo phoned Cologne to collect me. They have caught a good fish, they said. And at that moment, I decided I have to risk everything. And having worked on these camps, I had been given a phone number of the Gestapo. So if I encounter any trouble, I could phone them, because these camps were run with the permission of the Gestapo. And I had still this phone number. And I told them at the border station, if you arrest me, you are going to be in trouble, because I'm going to London at the instruction of the Gestapo to obtain visas for young people so they get rid of some Jews. They looked at me and said, well, here's the phone number of the Gestapo. You can phone them. Of course, not, if they had phoned, I would have been lost. But they didn't. The train was about to leave. They just checked whether this was a Gestapo number, and they said, all right, let him go. It was just that close again.
Did you meet Teddy Kollek?
I met him. He was ill at the time. I just met him, but I didn't.
And what were your first impressions of Britain when you got here?
Well, I was concerned about my what I'm going to live on. I had only 10 English shillings on me. And the person who employed my sister allowed me to stay there for 1 week, but after that I would have to find myself some means of sustenance. I had been given by my father the address of somebody whom he knew, who had left Austria before. I went there, and they had a house in Burnt Ash Road in Lewisham, and the lady was teaching the piano. They had come a year earlier. So I had a bicycle. So he said to me, the man, the husband, you know what, we are going to bake some cakes. You are going to get the orders on your bicycle. And during the week we bake them. And on a Saturday you carry them to these places, collect 2 and 6 pence for each cake, and we earn a few bob. And we did that. And that went on until food rationing, of course. That made an end to our eggs and all these goodies which went into these cakes.
And what was your reaction when you heard the news that Chamberlain had declared war on Germany?
We knew it was coming. It was nothing new to me. I was just surprised it took the English and the Allies so long to realize that you can't make a pact with a dictator. At that time I was an apprentice. When war broke out, I was an apprentice in the East End. I wasn't allowed to work, but I was allowed to be an apprentice. I learned cabinet making, only for 2 weeks. But they closed their doors the day war broke out. So I had to start looking after myself.
Did you have to appear before a tribunal?
Yes.
Can you describe what happened?
Oh, I was asked a lot of questions, of course. The person who had been good enough to guarantee for me suggested that he comes with me. And I said, but you don't really know me. I was always too honest. And he said, well, I can tell them. I said, well, I can't see that they can arrest me or anything. They know my background. So I went on my own. And apparently what I told them wasn't good enough. I got category B, which was I was allowed to be free until further notice. And then when, just before Paris fell, they arrested all or refugees, more or less, unless you had sea. The seas were not arrested. And I ended for 2 years in prison camps.
How did the policeman who arrested you behave?
Very, very nice and apologetic. They knew me because I had reported to the local police station. Very apologetic. And I remember I didn't want to take anything, and he said, I would suggest you take some warm underwear. You never know how long you will be kept there. So that was the first hint that I was taken to Kempton Park, race course.
Where were you arrested?
In Burnt Ash Road in
Lewisham. What was it like at Kempton Park?
Well, they were completely unprepared. We slept on the cement floor, no straw or anything. I don't know for how long, probably a week or so. And then we went by train to a place in the Midlands, a former textile factory. Again, completely unprepared, hundreds of people. We slept under the machines. The factory must have been closed for some time. The floor was all oily from the machine drops. We slept on this. It was very disheartening. And there we must have been about 2 or 3 weeks. Then we were taken to the Isle of Man. And from there, the unmarried people were one day all collected and sent to Liverpool and further on to Canada.
This was Douglas Isle of Man?
Pardon?
Douglas Isle of Man?
That was Douglas Isle of Man, yes.
What were conditions like at Douglas?
They were fine. Houses like this one, we had a whole hundreds of houses too at our disposal, and we cooked ourselves, and we had, within the borders, every freedom you could want. But one event stands out. One day, one of our fellows was called to the fence to talk to some high-ranking army or air force officers. It turned out the man with us was a fellow called Kronfeld, who was the world best glider pilot. He was world famous, and they didn't have anybody in the British Army to train. They didn't allow him out, but he could give from prison camp. He gave advice to the British Army how to even the Air Force people couldn't get this man out. Later on, he went to Scotland and helped them with the forming of the glider pilots, which was, of course, they were very important when it came to D-Day.
And your voyage to Canada?
That I shall never forget. First, I was so seasick, not only me, but we were underground, when I say underground, under deck. And German prisoners of war walked freely on the genuine prisoners of war, which they caught, a few they had. They walked freely on the deck and jeered at us who were below deck. And first we were seasick to such an extent I was praying that. We were just behind the Arandora Star, which was sunk by the Germans, with, I believe, 800 Italians and some others. And we saw them, and we couldn't stop because there was danger we would also be sunk. But we didn't know that at the time. And then after 3 days of seasickness, I woke up during the night and I felt I had a loose tummy. But not only me, all hundreds and hundreds of people. There was no toilet, there were only buckets there, and not that many either. And we all had to go, and it was terrible. The next few days were terrible in our upset before we settled down. When we settled down, we arrived in Quebec.
What was the name of the ship?
Ettrick, the Ettrick.
And who were the people who were jeering?
German soldiers, Nazi soldiers.
Did you respond?
No. There were barbed wire preventing us to come out on the deck. So if we had been hit, we would have been all drowned. You know, not even given a chance to swim or anything.
Which month was this? In the summer?
Yes. Was it? I would have looked up the record. It must have been July. And I remember it was terribly hot in Canada. Terribly hot. They let us standing in the sun for hours. And as we were then led to the fortress on top of the hill in Quebec, the fortress which was built by Wolfe. There were some army huts there. We went through the streets of Quebec and the people were jeering us and spitting at us. They thought we were German parachutists dressed up as Jews. That was their opinion. And then when we were at, first of all, we were locked into these huts, and one of the boys in my hut had to go to the toilet. But he needed to go urgently, so he was told, go do it out of the window. The window was, of course, full of barbed wire. So he went to the window to relieve himself, and he was shot dead from guards outside. And then an hour or two later, we were so tired, all of us. We were all woken up. Take all your things and come out. And there were the British soldiers who had accompanied us. And we were asked to throw everything on a blanket. We had watches, fountain pens, money. And they just robbed us of everything we possessed, the little we were able to save. You know, the little we had on us was taken away from us. So in the end, we had nothing but the suit we were standing in.
Were these British? Or?
British soldiers. Our soldiers who, they went down, as we heard later, they went down to pawn shop down in Quebec and pawned the watches and everything. Years later, we were asked, 2 years later, just before release, we were told to claim, and I think we got £5 or £10 compensation from the British War Office.
Did you see the shooting of this man?
The what?
The shooting of the internee by
It was in my camp, yes. It was in my hut, in my Nissen hut.
So was he just
a young boy? Perhaps the boy was perhaps 17 or 18.
Was he immediately killed by
a
bullet?
Yes.
Did you stay in Quebec camp very long?
I would say 2 months. I would have to refer to my records. 2 or 3 months. Once in the camp, we were all right. We got wonderful food, really. I mean, it's what we made of these army rations. We had a cook who, I believe, he was a cook in the Savoy or something like that. And our officers ate with us because their officers' canteen didn't produce the same quality food, with the same ingredients. It was very good food. I can't complain of anything. And from there, we were going by train to a place called Sherbrooke. Uh, don't know where it was. It seemed to be a long railway journey. But we were not harassed or anything. But in the camp we went on hunger strike because we were put into an old railway station with no preparation at all. There were army beds there, you know, two-tier beds, but that's all, no toilets, nothing. No cooking facilities, nothing. So we went on hunger strike and didn't last long, 2 days, I believe, and then they sent us equipment for toilets. I remember a long row of toilets, one next to the other, not divided or anything, you know, one like a bird on the telegraph wire, one next to the other. But that's the army. For us civilians, it was, of course, curious. But in the camp, a colleague of mine, from my school days, I had met in the camp, he was able to write a letter to America, to New York, and he knew somebody, and he sent him $100. And with these $100, he was allowed to start a canteen. And I helped him, and I was allowed out of camp to purchase in town. And I did this throughout my stay there. I was the only person of the camp, under guard, going to Quebec and maintaining contact with priests, Catholic priests, and we had some Catholics, but mostly Jewish people, 800 of us. But we had some famous people. I'll tell you whom we had. That's another riddle to me. Klaus Fuchs, he was an atom spy, you might remember. He was a non-Jewish person. He was in our camp. He gave lectures in mathematics. Brilliant person. But he made no secret of being a communist. He had a group of people like Heinz Kahle, K-A-H-L-E, who was a high-ranking officer in the Republican Army in Spain, a general in the Spanish Freedom Army, and such like communists, brilliant people, I must say. But how the British authorities later on didn't realize that he was a communist is a riddle to me. They could have asked any one of us. We had intimate contact with him for, I don't know, 1.5 years. Any one of us would have said, oh yes, he's a communist, a very nice fellow, but he's a communist. How the MI5 or MI6, whoever is looking up, didn't have the idea to ask us, I cannot understand. He made no secret. He was openly giving lectures on communism.
As well as mathematics.
That's right, yeah. But he was a very nice fellow, I must say. Very introvert person. Brilliant person.
Any other memories from Sherbrooke?
Well, I was very busy with the canteen. We were allowed to invest the profits we made on the canteen on improvements to the camp. And I remember I fought hard with the camp committee the first few $100. To buy radio equipment so we could hear the opera performance from Saturday afternoon from New York, which still is on the BBC now. The same, and the whole camp was quiet and listening to the opera.
How did you feel about being interned?
Well, we were